This week's Great Life is a man who defines post-war American theatre. Happens to be one of my favourite modern English-American writers. His early plays, poetic, tormented, controversial, brave in their themes, are landmarks in modern American literature. But in his later years, his life went sour. His new works were not put on. His phone calls to producers went unreturned. Tennessee Williams was also remembered as a man with a big laugh and a dry wit. He's the choice of my guest this week, stand-up comedian Rich Hall. Rich is an American in exile. He came here in the 1990s and soon won the Perrier Award. This was with his redneck guitar-playing alter ego, Otis Lee Crenshaw, who hails from Tennessee. Rich, why Tennessee Williams?
Why Tennessee Williams? Well, I always just thought that Tennessee Williams was a true outsider. Somewhat persecuted. I can't relate to the persecution part, but I can certainly relate to that outsider sensibility, which is, I think, most comedians can. That whole idea of looking at something tragic and trying to find a humor in it. I think Tennessee always, in a self-effacing way, claimed that what he was writing was comedy. Might have been a protective measure, but it's really, really funny and really dysfunctional.
When do you first remember hearing his work, noticing him?
My parents used to take me to the drive-in in Kentucky. He and my mom liked to sit in the car and make out and drink bourbon at the drive-in. So they'd make me sit out front. But they didn't want me kidnapped, so they'd make me sit right in front of the radiator. So this is the hot South in the summer, and I'm sitting in front of a radiator. Perspiration is just pouring off of me. They won't let me leave. The engine, you know, is practically exploding from the trip. And they give me some popcorn, and my dad sticks his head out the window and says, "Cat on a hot tin roof." I was like six, you know. I thought it was going to be, I don't know, I thought it was going to be about a cat. I don't know. I thought it was going to be hot, and it was. It was hot. And then I remember this faint stirring of seeing Elizabeth Taylor. I was only six, but something was going on.
So Tennessee Williams introduced you to heterosexual stirrings.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
What an irony.
And the heat.
And yet, Rich, though an outsider, he understood from the inside. He understood the people, the society, the culture that he portrayed from the inside.
That's part of the appeal, is that personally, he was homosexual in Missouri, Mississippi, where it was illegal, basically.
Sodomy was a capital offense in a number of states.
But the thing that appeals to me the most about his plays is his dissection of families, his dissection of family life, however, you know, screwed up it is. So many of his plays were about these families just being rendered, cutting through all the, particularly in the 50s and the early 60s, that sort of cheery idea that we had of families, you know, that white bread Eisenhower two-car garage thing. He just ripped it completely apart. I don't come from a really screwed up family, but I just found that amazingly entertaining.
Also with us on the line from New York is a man who knew Tennessee Williams well. Writer Dotson Rader first met the playwright in 1969 and remembered his friend in a book entitled Cry of the Heart, an intimate memoir of Tennessee Williams. It was published shortly after Tennessee's death in 1983. Dotson Rader, that is a fantastic name.
Not when you're seven.
It really is your name, is it?
Yeah, it's my name.
Because it's always said here that if you team up the name of your first pet with the maiden name of your mother, you'll get a porn star. And Dotson Rader, you were never a porn star.
I tried, but I never made it.
You knew Tennessee in the later part of his life.
Yeah.
Tell us how you met him.
I went to a party downtown. Basically, we were there to try to pick up, sex. And Candy Darling, who was this drag queen, just came over to me and sort of hissed, "Tennessee Williams is here and he wants to meet you." I said, "Tennessee Williams, I thought he was dead." Because I did. I did think he was dead. I said, "I thought he was dead." And she said, "No, he's not. He's here and he's my date." So this drag queen took me over to meet Tennessee. And he sort of looked me up and down and said, "Oh, baby, I'm in town, staying at the Elize Hotel. I was wondering, how much would you charge for dinner tomorrow night?" And I said, "Well, $200. And he said, "Ooh, well, what about lunch, baby?" And I said, "Well, that'd probably be $100. He looked up at me and said, "Perhaps we could settle for breakfast." And that's how I met him.
And were you lovers?
No. Don't defame the dead.
What is it about the man that drew you to him as a friend?
He was very full of life. He was very open. He had an immense sympathy for people who were struggling. And at that time when I met him, he was having problem with drugs and I had my own problems and I was a young writer. And so I didn't have any money. And he was attracted to people like that. And also I was gay. And so he was drawn, I think, to outsiders, which is probably why I would have loved Rich.
What did he look like? What did he sound like?
Well, he was short. I'm tall. He was about 5'7", I guess. He was very, very courtly. He cared very much of how he was dressed. He had a sense of being a gentleman, almost in a Victorian sense. If I used a swear word around some woman, he would call me on it.
Let's hear from the man himself. In 1959... Tennessee Williams recorded a program called Frankly Speaking with the BBC. He was asked whether his work was deliberately shocking.
I like shock in the theater. I love it. I love excitement. I was writing a piece recently. I said that I had two covenants with an audience. One was not to bore them, and one was not to deceive them. And I think not to deceive them comes first, but not to bore them comes very close after that.
I love the clipped, precise way he speaks, yeah. Almost as though he were dictating to a copy typist.
Yeah.
To me, that sounds like a very regional, slightly Charleston kind of accent. But he was growing up in Missouri, spending so much time in Missouri and then New York, I'm sure that his accent was probably washed out a bit. Mine is. I'm Southern. I have no Southern accent at all, practically, anymore.
His first really big hit was The Glass Menagerie, and two other works of his that I suppose everybody knows, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and A Streetcar Named Desire. All three are based in the Southern states. They're seen to epitomise the Southern American states. Now, you grew up in Kentucky and North Carolina.
Yeah.
Rich, how much does the South that Williams describes chime with you?
Well, he has a very gothic, overly theatrical, you know, women with the vapors and crumbling mansions, and it's a bit over the top. It's big. But that South that he painted was kind of destroying the old Gone with the Wind image of the South. Happy singing slaves and Atlanta burning, and they just milked this for years and years. And Tennessee Williams came along and just, there's lots of decay. When you see on his theatrical sets and in the films, there's lots of overgrown gardens and that always sort of allude to this sort of antebellum South that's gone. The cause, what they called the cause, which is their perverted psychological way of dealing with losing the war and slavery. There is a slight historical element to what he does. He never alludes to history ever. But there's faded glory about his character.
Faded glory. Yes, faded, yes, but glory too. And here I'd like your view on this, Dotson. I don't see the break with Gone with the Wind as quite so complete. The one, the Williams, is perhaps a ruin of the other, but I see a reflection of both.
I think I think Rich is right in the sense that he created a South that we can't. It's impossible to see the American South now except through his eyes and through Faulkner's eyes and through Margaret Mitchell's eyes. But to a degree, Tennessee was writing about the defeated nation. The great influence on him was his grandfather, who was an Episcopal priest in Mississippi. His grandfather was filled with the stories of the war. Tennessee will tell you, when anybody in his family referred to the war, they weren't talking about World War II. They were talking about the war between the states. Tennessee looks at the South and sees the values of gentility, of kindness, having been destroyed by the intrusion of these horrible values from the capitalist North that came into agrarian South and destroyed the culture.
How did this translate into writing? When, Rich, did he begin script writing? What sort of script writing did he start with?
I think he was always, it seems to me, always writing from a very early age. I'm amazed at people who write and write and write for no other reason than I think they just have to put it down. He also, much of his work reflected his real family, and he used his real family, his sister Rose and his mom and his dad, his sort of alienation that he felt with his dad because his dad wanted to be an all-American, big, macho guy, and he wasn't like that. And so many of his characters are barely transparent versions of his family.
And Rich is quite right. His plays are about families. His mother actually was a great beauty who married this drunken, abusive man. His father was a traveling salesman. You know, his name for Tennessee was Miss Nancy. Made fun of him constantly. And then he had his sister, Miss Rose, who had her own problems, and his little brother, Dakin, who I knew very, very well, who just died like 2 years ago. And he was remained devoted to Miss Rose until he died. She outlived him. And I think the great driving guilt of Tennessee's life was that he did nothing to intervene when his mother had Miss Rose lobotomized. He pretended he didn't know anything about it. He did nothing to stop the knife, as he says. And then it was too late. And I think Ms. Rose was the great love of his life. I don't mean that in any sexual
sense. Did he not
sense.
Try to intervene when she had a lobotomy?
No.
Did he not try to stop it? Did he think it was for the best?
I don't know why he did. I've never gotten out of him why he did it. He was up at Iowa. He was at school in Iowa at this point. I think he didn't want involvement. Whether he could have done anything about it or not, I don't know. But he didn't.
Dotson, how did The Glass Menagerie come about? That was his first big success in 1945, and the first play of his that I ever saw.
Well, that's an amazing thing that happened, because he'd done a play of the Battle of Angels in Boston, which was so badly received. Literally, the audience started throwing things at the stage. Tennessee said he had to sneak out of town to avoid being lynched.
Again, this is a reason that I relate to Tennessee.
Yeah.
I know that feeling.
I think the strength of the play and why he loved the play is that it's so unbelievably poetic. Tennessee's great gift is that he absolutely infused American playwriting with poetry.
The play is perhaps his most autobiographical. The shy Laura with her treasured collection of little glass animals, the domineering mother, and the frustrated warehouse worker, Tom.
I know. It seems unimportant to you what I'm doing, what I want to do, having a little difference between them. You don't think?
I think you've been doing things that you're ashamed of. People don't go to the movies at nearly midnight. The movies don't let out at 2 a.m.
I'm going to opium dens. I'm leading a double life. A simple, honest warehouse worker by day, by night, a dynamic czar of the underworld, mother. My enemies plan to dynamite this place. They're going to blow us all sky high. Some night I'll be glad, very happy, and so will you. You'll go up on a broomstick over Blue Mountain with 17 gentlemen callers, you ugly, babbling old witch!
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, the life of Tennessee Williams, chosen today by the comedian Rich Hall. Our expert witness in New York is his biographer and friend, Dotson Rader. Dotson, that play really was the foundation of his success, was it not?
That was the beginning of his success. He produced 3 or 4 major world-rank plays in a very short period of time. And I can't think of an American playwright who in a decade produced as much work that was not only critically successful, but was commercially successful. And that lasted until about 67, 68, when he ended up going completely loopy. But Tennessee, the thing about his family is that Tennessee fled it, but he couldn't escape it all his life. And he paid with a lot of torment, you know, booze and drugs. That was one of the ways he paid for it. You know, if he hadn't gone on to produce Streetcar, he probably would be Mart Crowley. Crowley's a wonderful writer, but he didn't have a follow-up success.
Rich, what about the films? Because his first three big dramatic successes, A Glass Menagerie and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and A Streetcar Named Desire, all three produced incredibly important and successful films, launched big names like Marlon Brando and Jessica Tandy. What was his legacy to cinema, and what did he think of cinema?
I think that his legacy to cinema is A Streetcar Named Desire probably changed the way that we watched films. Three of the main characters came off of Broadway, which is Marlon Brando, Kim Hunter, and Carl Malden. Vivian Leigh came in from left field, obviously associated with Gone with the Wind, but more of an old-style actor. And this dynamic that you see in that film from the very opening scene of Marlon Brando confronting Vivian Leigh is watching that crossover from old style, big budget production actresses who were gods and goddesses of the screen, to this modern Stanislavski method. And they are basically dancing on her grave. And she is brilliant in it, but she is so out of her league in this style. It's seeing this sort of realism come into film.
That realism, Dotson, the subject matter, I mean, take Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. The treatment of homosexuality there is pretty close to the mark for the era into which he was writing. How did audiences take it, and how did Hollywood film directors take it? Was it an embarrassment? Was it controversial? Did they play it down?
He had trouble with all the film renditions of his plays. And earlier, he had trouble with producers in terms of cuts to his plays because everything was toned down. One of the great things about him as a playwright, you have to go back to the Greeks to find subjects like cannibalism and homosexuality and incest and...
Cannibalism?
That said, well, yeah, well, that's something last summer.
Oh.
Who eats whom?
Sebastian's eaten.
Oh. Oh, my God.
Richard, yeah, you're a stand-up comic. You're a comedian. Where's the comedy here? Do you see him as a humorous writer?
Not in a jokey kind of way, no. But you look back at some of his stuff, and it's brilliant. It's brilliantly funny and brilliantly hilarious. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. The kids running around, these no-neck stumps of kids, do very funny stuff.
I went to a number of productions, opening nights with Tennessee, of Streetcar over the years.
Yeah.
And there's the last line of Streetcar is, "I've always depended on the kindness of strangers," which is probably Tennessee's most famous.
Mm.
And every time that line would be said, Tennessee would burst into loud peals of cackling. Laugh, very loud, and then look around, and because people would go shh, shh, shh. And he would look around offended because he wrote it as a laugh line.
He was outed, Dotson, by Time magazine in the 1950s. How hard did that hit him?
Well, I think it was 58. It didn't affect him in terms of theater, but it sure as hell affected him in terms of Hollywood, because people became nervous. I'm talking about studio actors became nervous of being known as a friend of his. And he was very much aware of that. He was deeply sensitive to homophobia. And if I could tell just one really brief little anecdote about him, 8 years or 7 years or so before he died, we went to a party, and it was for Cary Grant. And I was really excited. And we left, and I'm just on top of the world, and I'm telling him, "This is so wonderful, and they just love you so much." And he turned on me, and just in a rage, he said, "What are you talking about? Are you a fool? Don't you ever forget that when you leave the room, you're the cocksucker that just walked out the door. Don't you ever forget it." Meaning that if you're gay, you're received by straight society as long as you're useful to them. And when you're not useful to them anymore, they're going to treat you just the way they think of you, which is, frankly, I think I made the point, as his career, as he couldn't get plays now, which are being produced all over the place, but he couldn't get plays done, couldn't get them even read. His last play in New York, not a single critic showed up to review it. And some of the criticism at the end of his life was so unbelievably vicious. He thought of it, that a lot of it was just pure and simple homophobia.
Here's a recording made with Tennessee Williams by the BBC in 1970, just around the time of this turning of the tide. He'd recently spent some time in hospital being treated for violent and depressive behaviour, and he was asked if it's helped him feel fitter.
Well, you always leave something of you behind, you know? Yes, I feel fitter. It left on me a mark of great indignation because I was put in a snake pit with very few refinements, you know. It's just an ordinary loony bin, you know. It was not my choice to go there. I was put there by, I won't say whom, but I was put there.
Rich, it's really awful to hear the transformation in that voice.
He's stoned. Yeah.
He's stoned, you say, Dots?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's how he kept saying, you know. By the way, the one who put him there was his brother, Dakin. And he probably saved his life doing it.
Should we remember the drink, the drugs? Should we try to overlook it? Should we write it out of the record? Does it matter?
I don't think he could have produced what he produced without it. I never saw him go into a studio to work where he didn't have a bottle of wine with him. Not so much the drugs, but the liquor certainly allowed him to emotionally connect with whatever that center, emotional center inside in which creativity comes. And I'm sure Rich, when he does, you know, comedy, there's a point where I think you're...
I drink a lot, Dotson.
No, I'm not talking about drinking, but there's some, you have to use one trick or another, don't you?
Fortunately, it's a Snickers bar. Gets me going right before the show. But you said something in another interview that I heard that astounded me about American writers, that almost all the great American writers were alcoholics.
That's true.
And I never thought about that, but if you look at it now, you look at Tennessee, you look at Ernest Hemingway, you look at...
Faulkner.
Yeah.
Not Thornton Wilder. I won't give you Thornton Wilder, and I think he's a great writer.
When you get up on stage, you're defenseless. You may hide behind a persona, but you're Rich Hall, you're up there.
But there's an advantage to that if it's not funny. You know it's not funny.
You know right away.
Yeah, there's none of that neuroses of do they really like it? What's their agenda? There is no agenda. But as a writer, it's very lonely. It's got to be lonely.
It is lonely, but what you're putting on stage, Menagerie, is his life. All his work is his life. And being a playwright on opening night and sitting in that audience, you've got an immediate response. All your friends can tell you until they're blue in the face, oh, it was great, you've done it again, it's going to be here. And you got an audience leaving early, and it's opening night. Yeah.
Dotson, my closest encounter with Tennessee Williams came when I was at Yale in, I think, 1973, 1974. And one of his plays that in the end didn't prove a success, well, I guess the fact that it was touring New Haven shows that it wasn't proving a success. I thought it was brilliant, but he was by then being dismissed as a failed playwright. What had gone wrong?
I think a lot of people who have a lot of success very quickly in comparison to the amount of achievement. So you do one play and suddenly you're world famous, and in your heart of hearts you know somehow you're not worth it. And I think Tennessee, well, I know we talk, I mean, he did talk about it, he wasn't shy about it, that somehow he's going to wake up one morning, they're going to take it all away. And I think that's why near the end of his life, he was desperate. And because he was desperate, he allowed the money people, the producers, to intrude on what a play would be. And so he would have money people, you know, the wife of some goddamn car dealer in Detroit who's put in 50 grand, telling him, oh, I just don't think you ought to have that scene, Mr. Williams. Or, I don't think that line's rather offensive.
To me, one of the most tragic things about Tennessee Williams and something that I find myself relating to as a comedian is, to me, there's always been this sense that you only have so much good work in you.
Mm.
All writers, in that sense, are always wondering if they're past it, if they've done their best work. And I think it probably usually happens. And I look back at all the comedians that I admire, Woody Allen and Steve Martin, and to be honest, almost all of them may never be funny again and don't even try. And I think maybe one of the tragic things about Tennessee is he just really wanted to keep writing, hoping against hope that it would work again, you know, that he would revisit those accolades that he had in the past. But you're looking, I think, a pretty long period of time, possibly 10, 15 years. That's a long time to be wondering if you'll ever reach that form of glory again. It's a pretty painful thing to go through.
Marlon Brando said this about him on his death. He told the truth as best he perceived it, and never turned away from things that beset or frightened him. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think he told the truth. But, you know, you pay for truth. Truth doesn't come free.
Do you miss him, Dotson? And how will you remember him? And how do you think he should be remembered?
Well, I mean, I think he should be remembered for the way he's becoming remembered. All that would absolutely astonish him. He's just is the greatest of American playwrights. I think that would amaze him. I mean, he thought he was a wash-up, but I think that's his just desserts. I miss touching him, because he was shorter than me, and I could put my arm around him and grab his head, and I miss him.
It remains for me to thank our guest on Great Lives, the comedian Rich Hall, who chose the life of Tennessee Williams. Thanks, too, to our expert witness, Dotson Rader, Tennessee's friend. Goodbye.